Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Oriana, a novel of Oriana Fallaci, by Anastasia Rubis, narrated by Anthula Katsimatidis. Chapter 1, 2003. Go away. The handwritten sign is taped to her doorbell. For some inexplicable reason, she has agreed to see him and cracks open the door of her townhouse. He is ridiculously handsome, the Hollywood producer. Early 30s, she guesses. An irresistible age in a man. Warm, playful eyes, messy chestnut curls. Come in, she says. You might be the last person I ever speak to. The producer looks confused but recovers quickly. He's much younger than she expected and bounds in on long limbs. Ms. Fallaci, I'm a huge fan. Honored to meet you. He holds out an expensive-looking bouquet of white roses. For a moment, she stands stricken in the foyer. How did you know? Know what? His expression is open and curious. She accepts the flowers, caught for a moment in the plumpness of a creamy bud. Alekos used to give me white roses. Her heart does a little skip, saying his name out loud, though so many decades have passed and she has turned into a bony old woman. I didn't know. The producer's features settle into a tiny frown. She sees him furiously trying to figure out if his roses are a nice coincidence or if she is going to cry. No way, Mr. Hollywood. Oriana Fallaci never cries. He is here to discuss a movie that she doesn't want to make, but his title, Chairman of 20th Century Fox, and some instinct have made her agree to the meeting. She had a gut feeling she would like this man. And now that he's good-looking, with a friendly, exuberant air. How long has it been since she let a young man into her home? The three-story townhouse of white brick sits on a tree-lined street of the Upper East Side, a few blocks from Bloomingdale's. It is worth $5 million now. She's proud of her Manhattan real estate. Bookcases in every room, the ivory carpet cozy but worn. A mahogany staircase leading up to her bedroom and down to her study, the two rooms she lives in. On this floor, the formal living room with its antique, old lady furniture, stiff and unused. She has prepared herself for him with a deep red manicure, spritz of joy, black silk dress, accessories, of course, Ferragamo scarf to hide the wrinkles on her neck, ring on each hand, sapphire and ruby. Long ago when she jetted around the world on assignment, she dressed like a man, strictly pantsuits. At Lutèce once, a stuffy French restaurant in New York that critics swooned over, she was turned away for wearing pants. The last time she dined there. And to the Emperor of Ethiopia, who tried to decree her attire for an upcoming interview, she said, I come in pants, or I come in the nude. Today, all women wear pants, so she chooses dresses. There is still pleasure in going against the grain. Her hair is in a bun at the nape of her neck, thinned from the poison they dripped into her veins until she said, basta, enough. On her feet, felt slippers, like the heroic housewives of her mother's generation. It takes an hour to dress in the morning, the pain unbearable, until she swallows a pill. Come, I'll fix you something to eat, she says, leading the way to the galley kitchen. You're too skinny. She is aware she's flirting with him. The challenging tone, sardonic glance, and it's disorienting for a moment, transforming her into a younger self. The producer wears a charcoal blazer over black shirt and jeans, fashionable in his business, she knows, along with other modern touches. Stubble beard, citrusy cologne, leather messenger bag of good quality, maybe Prada. She scans for the triangular logo, and it is. His movements are bouncy and loose, matching something unself-conscious in his personality. She's jealous of his youth and lightness, as if nothing could go wrong, as if nothing ever has. Happy-go-lucky, that's what he is. An adjective no one could apply to her. "This is cotecino from my region," she says, slicing up a short red sausage at the counter. "Toscana, you know? You've never had sausage like this." "I'm kind of a vegetarian." "Not today." She fries it up, peppering him with questions about his fast rise at Fox because of some blockbuster movies. His education at Columbia? Philosophy. But he dropped out. Interesting. Exquisite to look at. He could be an actor himself. Nothing special about his brown eyes, but they crackle with light and good humor. His vocabulary is casual, his manner unassuming, but he's intelligent. She sees it in his quickness, the way he seems to catch meaning in the air effortlessly. "Cotecino is always paired with lentils," she says, serving him on a Vietri ceramic plate popping with color. "Eat." He sits on the lone wooden stool and eats. Although it's barely noon, she pours Dom Perignon into two crystal flutes, lights a cigarette. "You like it, Dennis Brady?" He has a nice name. She likes saying it. "Mmm." He devours the cotecino like a good carnivore, and she lets out a throaty laugh. "Aren't you eating?" he says, his mouth full. "Difficult these days. I get my nourishment from this." She toasts him with champagne. "Cancer, right?" he says with the frankness of a 6-year-old that startles her, then brings welcome relief. People tiptoe around the word. In Italy, it's taboo. So she went on television and said, "I have cancer. Cancer." What a breath of fresh air with this boy, not to hide her illness or be pitied. "My doctor at Sloan has officially given up on me." She hasn't admitted this even to herself. "How are you still alive?" he said last week, studying my x-rays. "I'm stubborn," I told him. "I never give in." Dennis Brady's face ripples with concern, but she fends it off. "It's an underrated virtue. You can get through a lot of life on stubbornness." The roses get stuffed in a vase, she'll deal with them later, and they go down one flight to her study. He admires her antique American flag from Argosy on East 59th, where she buys her cherished first editions. The Vietnam combat helmet displayed on her bookcase. The certificate for taking part in a U.S. bombing mission. Her framed photographs with Golda Meir, Indira Gandhi, Robert Kennedy, Arthur Miller, Walt Disney. He runs his fingers along the spines of her own books, editions in English, French, German, Arabic, 23 languages. "I don't know why you're here," she says abruptly. "Sit." He sits on the burgundy leather Chesterfield. She turns on the Tiffany lamp on the side table to see him better. "I've never sold the rights to any of my books. No one touches my babies." He reaches into his messenger bag and takes out a man with the shiny silver jacket that never fails to impress her, the stark purple letters. It's the best title she's ever come up with, direct and full of punch. "This was on my wife's bookshelf," the producer says, with a strange hitch in his voice. "I read it last winter. It's never left me." "Why?" She narrows her eyes at him. "It's a great love story, like Out of Africa or Reds," he says. "Easy there," she thinks, watching him launch into salesman mode. "Like all great love stories, there's something impossible about it. Tragic." The way Mr. Easygoing pronounces tragic raises her antenna. Maybe there's a deeper quality she hasn't given him credit for. "I have always had a tragic life," she says, getting up stiffly from the wooden bench, which oddly eases her back pain these days. Bones warming, she moves with her usual feistiness to her oak desk. It's awash in manuscript pages, stained espresso cups, a butt-filled ashtray, and of course her manual Olivetti typewriter. She's never gone electric, though now she can't find a damn repair place when a letter sticks. One framed photograph sits on her cluttered desk, and she brings it to her guest.
Alekos and I on the day we met.
She tries to sound offhand, staring at her impossibly young self, at his image frozen forever. The attraction emanating from both of them, their connection visible already. The producer holds the photo delicately, with a surprising flicker of emotion. Are you married? She says. He hesitates. I was.
Ah,
divorced, she concludes, and not his choice.
Then you understand me, she says.
Love doesn't stand up to scrutiny. Don't put it under a microscope, or a camera in your case. She tucks a stray hair into her bun. You remind me of him. He does. The 5 o'clock shadow, athletic pulse of his body. Her blue-gray almond eyes have always been her best feature. This morning, she has painted on a curl of black eyeliner, and she fixes them now on her guest.
Allora, you are proposing a movie I never wanted to make, but in the future I may want to make. You're rushing to buy the rights because next month I might be dead.
He shifts awkwardly but doesn't deny it. I don't have time to consider your proposal now, she says. The only reason I'm seeing you is that you tortured my assistant. I respect that, by the way. She said you're under pressure. The producer leans forward with concern. You're getting death threats. I have a target on my head. Her recent book about 9/11, an unapologetic warning against Osama bin Laden and his followers, has been wildly controversial. I didn't mean to bring it up. The producer rubs his hands along his thighs.
Why not? You might upset me.
You'd never make it as a journalist. The phone rings. Good morning, she says into it, curt. Yes, I'm fine, thank you. She hangs up. The police check on me every day. I'm being followed, sued. They're trying to ban my book. She levels her gaze at him. I'm a nasty woman, you see. A woman who says and does what she wants. That's what I want to make. A movie about a strong female protagonist. Maybe you should start with someone who doesn't say shit or fuck. They share a laugh. Don't you want everyone to know your story? He says. No, I'm very private. She drags on her cigarette. Who would play me? He names baby actresses she's never heard of. Why is he so interested in her? She can't make out. His last three movies, she's researched him, have recycled comic book heroes, nothing she would ever go to see. Her gaze drifts back to the photograph. She and Alekos on that bright August afternoon. Photographs were such devils. The image lifts her briefly, filling her with a warm glow, then drops her in midair, punching her in the throat. The longer she stares, the more unreal he becomes, as if he never walked the earth or is from a distant lifetime. The best thing happened to her, but it was so long ago it seems never to have happened at all. You know, she says, interrupting as the producer is describing Jennifer, somebody who won an Oscar. Just before I met Alekos, I was at the height of my profession. But when I looked down from my mountaintop, it was as if I'd climbed the wrong mountain. This is it? I was a woman alone, you see. Men don't face that. She doesn't say that in bed at night she had felt adrift in the universe, connected to no one, worrying who is going to love me. She had reached her 40s by then,
convinced there was something wrong with her. She didn't arouse tenderness, even if she was hungry for it, even if she felt beaten down at times and longed for a man to lean on. Then Alekos came along, wild and needy and 10 years younger. She could still feel his mouth on her skin, the way he took her with gentle insistence. Every woman should be loved by a younger man. "Before Alekos, I doubted that love existed," she says. "I hated love." "That's a good title," the producer says. "She hated love." "It's a terrible title." He has got her chatting, the trick she always used with her subjects. Get people talking about themselves and they'll drop their pants. Oddly, she doesn't give a damn. She likes the producer's lanky masculinity filling up her study. He is good company in this room where she toils to put words on the page. Most crucially, he's distracting her from the unspeakable task of getting ready to leave this earth. Finishing her last book, organizing her archives, attending to business she's never really cared about. Wills, royalties, legal issues with her publisher. She doesn't want to go. She loves life, even when it's cruel and gives her suffering. "More champagne?" she says. They clink glasses. He has caught her at a moment when she's sleepless at 4 in the morning, turning over the pieces of her 73 years. What she did, what she should have done but didn't, what she deserved but didn't get. Her wins, oh, she likes winning. And her damn sorrows. How she hates people who proclaim, "I have no regrets." She has plenty. She torments herself with her mistakes. Most of all this, no child. An Italian woman without Sunday gatherings of La Famiglia. A true fiasco. She feels it intensely now. The failure to fulfill her biological purpose. She has missed out on the pleasures of inhaling a baby's scalp, carrying a bundle on her hip, cheering on first steps. Now when she dies, she will really die, leaving no trace of herself behind. The looming void ahead, the nothingness terrifies her, though she would never admit it. She has made a career of being insanely brave, tough as nails. How has she ended up so alone? Traveling back in time to extract some meaning doesn't work. The pieces of her life have passed so quickly, this decade, that decision. They're so cruelly faded, she can hardly recapture their details or essence. Only sometimes, only briefly. In the end, there is so little to hold on to. For damn sure she has never fit into any conventional box or let anyone else define her, telling her what she can and cannot do. Late at night, rewinding her choices, she has concluded only one thing. We are not here to make sense. We are here to have guts and to act, to do something with our lives, have an adventure. And that she has done. If the charming producer wants her story with Alekos, maybe she'll give it to him. Her version, of course. I am the boss, I decide. A movie might be her chance to set the record straight, to have the last word. She's always satisfied by that. Just recently, some imbecile had the gall to write, "Falaci was never truly in love with Greek patriot Alexander Panagoulis, though she claims he was her great love. He was only her fantasy hero." They only did this to women, denied them authority, even over their own hearts. The producer is watching her, calculating if in an hour he can get out of here with her signature on a contract. He's wonderful and awful to look at, the same age as Alekos when she fell off the cliff. She wets her lips with a sip of champagne. "I almost didn't go to Greece that day," she says. "Thank God for my enemies." "Your enemies?" He angles his head. "Come on, you must know this by now," she says, her tone brash, flirtatious again. Life is full of enemies, Her voice turns gravelly, saying this last almost to herself. They push you harder to win. Chapter 2. 1973. Oriana Fallaci hunched over her desk doing what she did best, taking a drag of her cigarette, setting it down on her typewriter over the burn mark, and attacking the keys. Attacking any bastard who dared insult her. Dr. Kissinger, you accuse me of distorting your answers. Do you remember I taped our interview with your permission? I have told Time, Newsweek, and the networks I can release those tapes to help your recollection. Laser-focused, she reread her telegram. Fought the temptation to change the salutation to Dear ICE Vader, Dear Pompous Little Professor. Release her tapes, her prized interview tapes? Never. But Icy didn't need to know that. It was a sweltering August afternoon in the center of Florence. Fans whirred, papers rustled on desks, the windows were thrown open to the muffled sounds of afternoon siesta, and the city emptied out for Ferragosto holidays. A mixture of perspiration, too much cologne, and heavy cigarette smoke thickened the air. Oriana yanked out her telegram and walked it across the newsroom. Send it to Henry Kissinger at the American Embassy in Paris, she said to Lucia, the alert young secretary with waves of auburn hair, where he is once again holding peace talks to North Vietnam that will fail to bring peace. Ciao, she jutted her chin at her editor, Tommaso Giglio, through the door of his private office. He was his usual calm, cultured self on the phone, swiveling in his chrome and leather chair, facing Florence's best street, the cafe-lined Lungarno Vespucci, running along the Arno River. Back at her desk, she threw her legs on top, crossing them, and lit another cigarette, briefly approving the wedge sandals and pencil pants hugging her thin silhouette. She was 44, but didn't look it. In fact, she could feel the libidinous glances of male colleagues this minute, mixed, of course, with the complicated soup of who the fuck does she think she is. Female success pissed people off. It was not at all revered like male success, a lesson she'd learned early. Too bad. She would never downplay hers. Her gaze swept over the all-male newsroom, save Lucia and the cleaning woman, reaching into corners with her feather duster. Always men surrounding her in this profession. The irony was, she preferred men. Or rather, she'd learned how to become one of them, more than women. From a messy stack on her desk, she was messy. Oriana took the latest L'Europeo, the weekly news magazine where she'd been a correspondent for, Christ, how long was it? 19 years? L'Europeo was every bit as good as Life, with a mix of hard and soft stories covering politics, society, and the arts. Her interview with King Hussein of Jordan was on the cover. She made a noise of satisfaction seeing her name in bold above the headline. No matter how many times she published her byline, it seemed a miracle to her, and she had the complicated reaction of disbelief and wanting to give herself a hugely deserved pat on the back. Skimming her piece, she approved the sharp wording, stopping only once to think, no, a different adjective would have better described the king. She remembered how dejected Hussein had looked a month ago at his palace in Amman, so small in his grand armchair, his feet barely touching the ground. She kept forgetting to call him Your Majesty. Are you losing power, sir? She hit him with the impertinent question early. As usual. The king was in the news, central to the conflict between Palestine and Israel. She always interviewed leaders at the moment they became critical on the world stage, asking questions everyone was desperate to know. It took meticulous research. She killed herself to be informed. Of course, she asked personal questions, too. King Hussein would have rather been a pilot or a lawyer. He hated being king. Sticky from heat, she flicked back her hair, long, ash blonde, and parted in the middle. What a relief not to be running to the hairdresser as she did in the 1950s and 60s, when she was interviewing all those vacuous Hollywood stars. The women's topics, she started with. Ciao, Oriana. Mulatti breezed into the newsroom. The young upstart wore a tan safari jacket with a wide tie and flashed his predator's grin. "What a surprise, you here with us, international superstar." She rarely came in, it was true. She was flying off to Germany tomorrow. She gave him a look anyway. "This is what Newsweek calls you." Mulatti waved the roll magazine in his hand. "Give me." She flew up and grabbed it from him. "Is this my copy? Why didn't they send me one?" There was her picture, decent, still juice in her. Her eyes raced over the text. Not bad. Greatest political interviewer of her time. Spitfire. Never intimidated by those in power. They even quoted her correctly. "Presidents and kings are no better than us, no more intelligent or competent. In fact, they're often stunted and inept. Why should I bow down and tremble before them? On the contrary, I give them hell." Newsweek. A profile of her, though only a paragraph. She couldn't believe it. Mulatti was jealous. She could feel it with her intuition. And when she glanced up, there it was on his face. His tanned face, from a holiday in Sardinia or Ischia or who knows where. "It took me 2 decades to get here." She wagged the magazine at him. "I've had to work twice as hard as a man, but I'm thrilled. You know why? It's made me better." He gave her the wolf grin. "Let me buy you an espresso." "Finally, you have a good idea. Medium sweet." He summoned the coffee boy with the swinging brass tray making his daily rounds from the corner cafe. Oriana leaned back on her desk and toasted Mulatti with an exaggerated gesture before downing her espresso. Why did the little worm have to land here, at her magazine? Damn Italy and its nepotism. No shortcuts for her. Of course not. "Tell me, Oriana, how much do the Americans pay when they translate your articles?" Mulatti said with a wink. "None of your business." "I want to do the same one day." She scoffed. "Good luck." The little prick had no idea what it took, the effort she'd exacted from herself. Something in his demeanor made her ask, "What are you working on?" Mulatti was making a show of generously tipping the coffee boy. "I'm leaving for Athens to meet the Greek who just got amnesty." "What Greek?" Her antenna shot up, watching him expand his chest. "The hero who tried to knock off the dictator 5 years ago. Rapidly, she calculated. 5 years ago, she was in Mexico City, covering the student protest turned massacre, the most dangerous story of her career. "The Greek was tortured in prison, but never broke," Mulatti said. "Now the dictator set him free." He drew himself up. "Oriana Fallaci covers war and rebellion and doesn't know this freedom fighter?" She shot him a withering look. He addressed her with too little respect, this 25-year-old who had not the slightest idea how to report. "Coffee break finito," she said, bulldozing past him to the editor's office. Tommaso was leafing through the new issue with his keen, judicious eye. Lovely man. She had the same thought she always had. Salt and pepper hair, impeccably dressed in a slim khaki suit. The kind of intellectual she respected, unpretentious, though published, currently working on a new translation of Alice in Wonderland. She had become world famous under his wing. She owed him a lot. Especially since he had the good sense to let her be the boss. "Where's Mulatti going?" she said, crossing her arms. "To interview him." Tommaso nodded toward the television on its mobile stand and circled his desk to join her. She stared at the RAI news footage of a young man, 30-ish, with jet black hair, squinting outside a barbed wire prison, blinded by sunlight, his face quivering with pent-up tears. A woman in black, his mother, the newscaster said, rushed toward him and threw her arms around his neck. Oriana felt her own throat constrict, watching the dissident's first moments of freedom. She observed the
Sample complete. Ready to continue?